various different releases, that not full releases, I should say, just kind of things that we put out with a few songs on them to so people could enjoy.
They're very well produced and sound great.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would like to have a copy for the station here. Maybe
could people. Oh, you don't have a copy for the station right
well,
now?
No,
you
I have
your
my
personal
own copy.
Yeah. All right, we'll get you copies of everything for the station.
Wonderful.
Okay, you can put it in the library and people can choose to play if they so desire.
I know. People may ask, who was that great band? And I'll say, yeah, well, I had them in here.
Superior Olive.
And we got time for about another song. At least one more song.
Hey, guys, we can do something off of our first album called Mary Had a Little Lamb.
Okay. This one here is, the title is from a nursery rhyme, but the song itself is not that nursery rhyme. It's also not the Stevie Ray Vaughan song of that same name.
Oh, all right.
I wrote it before he wrote that one.
But it has a great keyboard part, huh, Gary?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
This has been a fine hour with Superior Olive. I just love it. I just want to keep listening. Come on, listen some more.
Oh, thank you, Coral.
Well, that's the problem with time. It runs out sometimes.
Well, it was a great way to spend the last hour. And I'm sure all of you were tuned in and loved it so much you just couldn't break away and call. But if you do want to call in the next 5 minutes, our number is 427-3772. This is the Tangerine Dream Team Hour, 100% independent live music. Well, not always live. Independent music, at least, 100% original. And we like, you know, the second hour, the 7 to 8 p.m. hour, we play artists that we like and that I like, especially. And that are great. So it was great having you here. Say your names. And again, Gary, you're...
Gary Goldsworthy on the keyboards.
Mm-hmm.
Joel Savelle on the bass and sometimes vocals.
And Tom Savelle on guitar, vocals, and violin.
That's excellent. So we hope your tour turns out just a smashing success.
Well, thank you. And, of course, stay tuned to those websites, myspace.com/superiorolive or just superiorolive.com should contain links to all of those places. And we'll keep our tour date schedule posted up there. Right now, it probably doesn't show anything because we don't have our tour dates completed.
Mm-hmm. So maybe I'll just end up with one of your tunes on your album here.
Awesome.
And thank you again.
Again, no, I don't want. denied me.
And that was the Tangerine Dream Team for the last hour or so. You can hear them again on Tuesday night, 6 to 9. That's Tangerine Dream Team. They've got stuff that I'm often interested in and should be listening to more. But now it's time for Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. That's 2 hours of, well, me selecting articles, bits of tape, hopefully getting a phone call or two, and I think coming up in about 3 or 4 minutes, an incoming call from co-founder of Food Not Bombs, Keith McHenry. Food Not Bombs is an organization that's been around for 30 years, actually kind of an idea, a label, a moral cry for justice that has echoed throughout the country, throughout the world, actually, with individuals throughout the world starting independent groups called Food Not Bombs that have no central organization. They have no Congress or series of representatives. They are simply grassroots activists in each individual community serving food that often is made up of food that's thrown away by grocery stores but still good to use, vegetarian and vegan food usually. Food at events that emphasize justice and the kind of the fundamental idea of let's spend our resources on food and not bombs. And there's often for the Food Not Bombs been a very much of a positive and determined support for homeless people in different communities, particularly in Santa Cruz and San Francisco, where I've actually spent time serving with Food Not Bombs at different points in the past. I'm a supporter of it. I talk about it a lot on the air, or at least regularly. And Keith McHenry has gone around the world pushing, helping, cutting up carrots, you name it, and he'll be coming on in about 2 or 3 minutes. I did talk to him about an hour and a half ago. He is, I believe, in Taos, New Mexico, about to speak at a big mountain rally. And that's another political cause that we haven't heard much about, I haven't heard much about for the last few years, or haven't been listening much for. But a decade and a half ago, it was an activist focus in Santa Cruz at the hub, at the info shop where we were. I guess there was a series of activist organizations for about a year and a half, 2 years, not sure how long, including Free Radio. We had space right behind the Civic Auditorium. That was in 1999, and we were going strong, and different groups met there, and there was a library there. It was all kind of a nice nexus focal point. The Sub Rosa, in a smaller way, provides that kind of option now, in a sense. So, although it's nowhere near the space and nowhere near the number of groups that kind of come together in a coalition. But this sounds like an incoming call, and I bet I know who this is. Hey there, you're on Free Radio.
Thanks. Yeah, this is Keith with Food Not Bombs.
Hey, I was just talking about you and Food Not Bombs throughout the world. That is to say, different, many, many different Food Not Bombs groups that you have been running around poking and examining and supporting and things like that.
Well, thanks. That's nice of you to think of us.
Well, you know, I mean, I was tuned. I went into your website to check it out. And, of course, I've been concerned about mostly about actions against homeless people in cities like Columbia, South Carolina, where they're driving people out of the homeless downtown very explicitly with an actual law. And then they have the so-called shelter jail, which they send you to. If you don't agree to stay there, they'll arrest you. At least that's the law. And I don't know if they're actually going to try to carry this out. That would be quite something. But you've been traveling around, and you know what's the latest with Food Not Bombs? I know that your focus is often on ensuring the right for people to serve free food at will without being interfered with by authorities.
Yeah, well, you know, there's been a lot of flurries activity with the Raleigh, North Carolina problem, where the police came out to stop this church group from serving, and it turned out Food Not Bombs was one of the targets of the police, Raleigh Food Not Bombs. But fortunately, because as has happened a few times recently, when there's a lot of energy towards outlawing free meals, it seems like the city governments have recently been backing down. kind of freaked out by all the publicity. It's amazing. I mean, I even received an email today from Michael Moore, like one of his staff, just personal email, you know, sending me a link to what was going on in Raleigh, because people are just really outraged that that would ever happen.
What is going on in Raleigh? Fill us in.
Okay, so what it turned out that happened was a couple of days ago, maybe a week ago now, one of the local church groups that was providing meals out there in a city park was approached by the police and told to stop and that they'd be arrested. And on their website, and unfortunately I can't remember the name of the group, but it was a nice, you know, kind of a sort of like the Vagabond church that had been busted down in New Orleans when we were, in Orlando when we were starting to get arrested there. It was, you know, a street church. And so they got, they were told to stop. They put out photos and a press statement about how they had been told to stop. And fortunately, people rallied around them, and then the city government came out a couple of days ago and said they would not actually enforce the law, but apparently not, they are not going to remove the law. And the same thing, a similar thing has been happening.
Well, let me focus. Keith, let me.
Have a law against sharing food.
Keith, let me. Keith,
some pushback.
Keith, let me interrupt you for a moment and go, and stay with Raleigh for a moment. I actually looked up the. I put out an email on this to HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom groups. Perhaps because I heard from you, or perhaps I got it from somebody else. The group is called Love Wins. Ministries. And
yeah, Love Wins Ministries, correct. Right.
And it says that they were frequenting Moore Square in Raleigh on Saturdays and Sundays to give out hot coffee and a breakfast sandwich to those in need. But when they went down to dole out 100 sausage biscuits and the gallons of coffee they had brought to feed the crowds who gathered Saturday morning, they were greeted by officers from the Raleigh Police Department. They bluntly said if they attempted to distribute food, we'd be arrested, according to Reverend Hugh Hollowell. We asked the officer for permission to disperse the biscuits to over 70 people who had lined up waiting to eat. They said no. Now, if you were, of course, were doing that, would you be asking those officers permission? What would be your approach to that?
Well, of course not. And I don't think the local Food Not Bombs actually was, asking permission. They were just continuing. And I did read two articles where they did have some statements by local Raleigh Food Not Bombs about how they would resist and that it was their right. And my, I think that it's really important for people to resist and not ask permission. And it may be, and it seems like from the article published on the Love Wins website or their blog, that they were not exactly aware of the fact. In fact, I've seen a bunch of reports saying that this is, on Common Dreams even, it mentioned this, that this was a new thing, wow, how outrageous. Somebody is going to, be threatened with arrest for sharing free food. And I noticed also in the Common Dreams report that made that allegation, that somehow this was a new problem, that many people commented that it was not a new problem, but that it, in fact, had happened for years now that people have been being busted for sharing food with the hungry, so that it was not really a new issue.
It seems to me that one of the reasons to not start asking permission from police agencies and city bureaucrats whether you can do things is it's not simply that I think Food Not Bombs and others who just go ahead and do what is a natural and a positive thing to do are doing it is not because they want to challenge police necessarily, but because it's important, I think, in a matter of living one's life that you continue to do things without seeking some kind of approval from an authority nearby. If what you're doing is a natural thing, otherwise this gives the authority first of all, inhibits you from a normal activity, and it also gives unusual power to authorities who seem to be power mad these days. Or am I being a little extreme here?
No, I think you're right. I mean, the issue for me is, any human being to be able to help some other human or just, you know, hand out things, share food, you know, help somebody if they have a flat tire, you know, help people cross the street. There's all kinds of things people should be allowed to do that should be unregulated, like basic human things. And it's kind of remarkable. I mean, I don't think there's any other country in the world that has gotten to the point that the United States has gotten to where there's this idea that everything has to be regulated. And it's just, it's a horrible trend. And I think, you know, one of the overriding, you know, so from my point of view, you know, compassion should not be regulated. And you know, it's our food. It's our business. You know, we are the people that are taking out the food. If you want to do that, then that's great. If you want to hand out free books in the streets, that should be fine. If you want to give free massages, you know, on the street corner, you know, you should do that. You know, why is the government getting involved in all this stuff?
You know, it's interesting.
You know, even vegetable gardens.
It's interesting you
can
say that.
You know, there's like a clamp down on that. That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, as they have here in Santa Cruz. In fact, I'm going to be playing an interview with a seller of the local homeless paper, the Bay Area paper, Street Spirit, Raven, who has been advised that she risks arrest if she gives massages anymore on the street for a charge, which she does because she's homeless and she needs, you know, to get something for it. It's also, I think, it's interesting, another part of the story that I was looking at in Raleigh is apparently, as you say, this is nothing, well, I don't know if it's new or not new, according to the story. It isn't new, according to what you've told me. But according to this, the group, this story says, while the group said it was aware that they could not use the park itself, which is an abuse of the public authority to deny people access to a park, they had set up on the sidewalk for the past 6 years without issue, their website said. No representative from the Raleigh Police Department was willing to tell us which ordinance we were breaking or why, after 6 years and countless friendly and cooperative encounters with the department, they're now preventing us from feeding hungry people. Also, they learned to apply for a permit. It would cost $800 a day. Did you find similar problems in San Francisco when you were serving 2 decades ago? I mention that because that really was a period of most intense persecution of food, not bombs, ever, in terms of over a sustained period, or would you agree with that?
Yeah, no, it definitely was. There was over 1,000 arrests. The police were, you know, violent often, you know, attacked, beating people. We have actually a video online called Food Not Bombs Greatest Hits. And the things that they did, and I think this became kind of the hallmark or the, you know, kind of ultimately after the experience of San Francisco, something I have shared with anybody being threatened with arrest, with the phony permit issue, you know, the asking permission from the government to do a normal activity, is that, you know, we went through all these hoops. We bought $1 million liability insurance, which cost like $1,500. We, you know, they waived some like $500 fee for permits, claiming they were being so nice, but then you ended up spending, we had to get money from Haight-Ashbury Neighborhood Council to buy all kinds of equipment to comply. Again, we had to do benefit concerts to, you know, buy the food, you know, liability insurance in case, somebody got sick, even though at that time there was already, I believe, the Good Samaritan Act that had been passed around that same time, which, the federal law for, you know, making it so no one has to worry about being sued for sharing food with the hungry.
Now, is that law still operational?
It's just a boondoggle.
Keith, is that law still operational? Is that federal law still actually active?
And just,
I guess you didn't hear me.
You know, I'm a little shocked that they are so naive to believe that somehow all that makes sense, you know, to be on a sidewalk as opposed to a park, to be, you know, concerned about paying $800 to do a normal human activity. I mean, if we get to the point where we're paying thousands of bucks to, you know, have a permit to help people repair their tires on the side of the road.
I mean,
we're going to be in real
trouble. Actually, this is something we could go into in detail, but you've got to be speaking in 15 minutes at a big mountain support rally, right?
Right, yeah. There's a very, when I lived in San Francisco, during the period of time when we were getting arrested, we were starting to, Bruneau Bonds was actually organizing campaigns to raise money to buy organic food to take out the Big Mountain. And that the issue of Big Mountain has a huge influence on why I do Bruneau Bonds, because when I was a child, I lived at the Grand Canyon, and my grandfather was friends with people near Big Mountain, and we'd go out there all the time. And in those days, in the early 60s, there was no Glen Canyon Dam, no Lake Powell, no huge, strip mining for coal. There weren't all these, coal-generated power plants. And it was unbelievably pristine and beautiful. And it just was tragic when I was 16, 17 years old to see this amazing area be destroyed. And one of the techniques of the government to destroy this natural habitat and this beautiful sacred Four Corners area was to pit different native peoples against each other. And so we started organizing, actually a woman here in, who currently lives here in Taos, New Mexico, Martha, has worked with the native people, Dene and Hopi, in the Four Corners area on a thing called a survival camp. And the idea is, so tonight we're showing a movie and raising funds for that, because it's a really important effort. The things that are the type of corporate power and exploitation and damage that we're seeing in the Four Corners, there was a belief that that was out of sight, out of mind, just some native people, who cares for stealing their land and their water and their resources and destroying something amazing and beautiful. No one will see it. But that's, of course, now spread to the whole rest of the world. That's directly connected to the exploitation that has caused governments to create cruel laws against the homeless.
Keith,
the same kinds of laws are used against the native people of, of the Four Corners. So
Keith,
that's the
project
we're doing tonight.
Keith, are you on speakerphone?
No, I'm on just a cell phone standing in a parking lot.
Oh, because I've been, occasionally I try to interrupt you and I can't get through. And, interruptions are very important things. So try to be interrupted a bit better, will you?
Okay, I'll try to do that.
We haven't got much time. You got about 12 minutes before you're going to start at your time.
Yeah, I should probably go pretty soon anyway. And I'd be happy to speak on Sunday on your program. So,
Any last kind of summary about Big Mountain and what this issue is for those who don't know it, and what you're trying to do in terms of this, what this survival camp is about?
Yeah, so basically, there are renewed efforts by Peabody Coal and other transnational corporations to mine more coal, to build a third power generator at Shiprock, coal power generator, so it's related to the climate change issue, because they're burning dirty coal, and this electricity goes to California, largely also to Phoenix and other metropolitan areas. And we're trying to stop further exploitation of this region. And this benefit tonight, we're showing videos and raising money to support the native resistance there. So, that's the kind of thing that we're doing. And it's a combination of uranium mining, coal mining, destruction of ancient Anasazi ruins, the pollution of the land, and then maybe more most dire to the Navajo and Hopi people is the fact that all their fresh water is threatened, because it's needed by these corporations for slurry lines to transport coal to power plants nearby, which ultimately destroys all this water, poisons it, and it can't be used again.
Well, look, why don't you, I guess you'll be calling in at 9:30 on Sunday morning when we continue this conversation?
Yes, and I should know a lot more about, like, where the Raleigh issue is. I'm getting other emails about other problems in other cities, you know, Portland, Boulder, Seattle, and Detroit are all cities where Funa Bombs is currently under threat. And this weekend, Saturday, we should know if a number of those cities were actually confronted, arrested, or threatened with their Saturday meal.
Sounds good. I mean, or, well, at least to know what's going on certainly is good. Hopefully you'll get good news and you'll pass it on to us, and you'll let us know how things are going at the Big Mountain scene as well, which I haven't really looked at for years, and I guess you're close to the whole issue being in Taos. We're talking with Keith McHenry, co-founder of Food Not Bombs. For more information before Sunday, for those who are eager beavers, go to where, Keith?
Go to foodnotbombs.net or call us at 1-800-884-1136. And again, you know, it's foodnotbombs.net.
Hey, thank you very much.
Well, take care, Robert.
Talk to you again.
Bye.
All right, man. Bye-bye. And that was Keith McHenry, co-founder of Food Not Bombs. I'm Robert Norris, and you're listening to the stream of Free Radio Santa Cruz on freakradio.org. We are not broadcasting, as far as I know. We are transmitting, however, and archiving by stream, which is better than nothing, but not a hell of a lot better. So if you want to help out, let us know any information you may have about a transmitter site in the Santa Cruz area. That would be a tall tree, a second story or third story of a building, a floating dirigible or a zeppelin possibly, a lot of hot air from politicians lifting your building up into the stratosphere. In other words, someplace where there's a high place for a transmitter to be put. It's we are an illegal station. We are a pirate station. We believe, however, we are a community-positive station, which passes on to the community information that they would not otherwise be aware of. We give artists and activists an opportunity to speak and perform in ways that other outlets do not. We don't take any commercial advertising, though I sometimes push this or that. I give credit to, I think, different businesses and different individuals who I think have been of benefit, for example, in the homeless rights struggle, which I'm particularly concerned about. Though I'm in no way any representative of any homeless group, HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, is a group which is composed largely of housed people, but also some homeless people, and concerned with the civil liberties issues involved. And we have our own opinions, and I have my own opinions. Sometimes my opinions are different than those of the HUF organization. But I think they're worth raising, and I try also to put out a lot of homeless voices on this station, which you'll be hearing later in the show, and hopefully you'll be calling in, because we do have two call-in numbers, 831-427-3772. That is, grab your pencil. You grab your pencil now, 831-427-3772 and 831-469-3119. It's 831-469-3119. This show is archived, this particular show, not all free radio shows, but this particular show is archived, and it's a twice-weekly show called Bathrobes, Pierres, Broadsides, at the HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom website, HUFSantaCruz.org. One word, small letters, HuffSantaCruz.org. So you can hear what you've missed there. If you're listening to this show on August 29th, then you're hearing it live, and you are certainly invited to call in and give updates, comments, thoughts, whatever you got. And again, the number is 427-3772-469-3119. I'm going to take a brief musical break, and I'll be back talking at you, and hopefully you'll be talking back to me.
Campfire and sing the whole night long.
And that was Phil Free, a long-time, old-time Free Radio broadcaster who isn't with us anymore, but he's in the community. And thank you, Phil, for that song. It's an old one from the 90s, and it's still not a bad idea, because the mayor, this particular mayor, Hillary Bryant, has been quite the cheerleader for criminalizing homeless people and creating the Task Force on Public Safety, which actually is the Task Force on Public Hysteria that is designed to buttress and amplify bigoted notions that the presence of homeless people is somehow an incitement to crime, that a lot of homeless people are criminals and are drawn here by all the wonderful homeless services that exist, which, of course, is nonsense. And the needles, the many needles that have been collected and shaked in the face of the city council in little glass jars that the Clean Team and Take Back Santa Cruz and other groups have brought to city council. And, you know, it's good people are picking up needles, sure, and cleaning them. But with the political purpose of demonizing another group and rousing hatred and fear in the community, no, that's not such a hot idea. Although, I have to say, I've got nothing against hatred of injustice and hatred of incompetence and hatred of stonewalling and hatred of corruption. Yes, I agree with those things. But demonizing a particular group, which I think seems to be a persistent theme of Take Back Santa Cruz and such groups co-founded by City Councilmember Pamela Comstock, supported by Councilmember Lynn Robinson, and also by Councilmembers Terrazas, Matthews, and Mayor Bryant. Plus, you know, bringing up the rear, apologizing and bowing and scraping Don Lane and Micah Posner. The council will not take a strong stand against the sweeps. Individual council members are not taking strong stands on this. The destruction of people's property is continuing to happen in this community. What we at Huff have been doing recently, at least for a couple of weeks. It's been a couple of weeks now since we were at the front of Cruzio Works, an organization that provides computer space and computer access on a 24-hour basis to those who pay them a hefty fee. They denied service to Dan Madison, who now does a show in Santa Cruz under the name Sean, at 1 o'clock after my Sunday show. I'll probably be expelled for mentioning that, but Dan is, he and his son, who are computer workers and actually earn money through doing this kind of thing, creating, I guess, 3D imaging. They've got I haven't actually seen their work or gone back to check it, but according to their accounts, that's the kind of thing they do. They were denied access to Cruzio after they had paid money, gotten a contract, also because of the fears of a one unknown individual who wouldn't identify herself or claim what her concern was. I have a call, so I'm going to take this call. Hey there, you're on Free Radio, or at least the stream of Free Radio.
Hey, Robert, it's Mike Rose.
Oh, hey, Mike. I'm glad you're calling in. You, of course, are... I completely forgot you were calling in, but how could we forget what you're doing in Fresno, which is actually mobilizing to document the destruction of the homeless encampments and to take the message to the shitty council... I'm sorry, the city council of Fresno, yeah?
Well, there were about 20 or 30 people down at City Hall today telling the city council members, who happen to be all men... What we think about their policy on homelessness in Fresno, which is just about as bad as you can get at this point. They not only, you know, have gone through a very long period of doing absolutely nothing to help people, now they're actually making life more difficult for people who are homeless.
And the way they're doing that is with bulldozers and nose counters and blanket seizers and shelter destroyers, that sort of thing? Or?
Yeah, starting this Monday, they are implementing a new policy of destroying all of the homeless encampments in the downtown area where people, last week, had a place to sleep out of the weather, whether it's, you know, the 110-degree scorching heat that you have in the summer or the rain in the winter, people build little homes and we're living in them. Uh, much nicer than, say, just a tent, although, you know, tents are better than nothing. Now, people actually build some pretty elaborate shelters for themselves here and put them together in neighborhoods where they knew people and people could look out for them. And there's hundreds of people living in small communities in downtown Fresno. And so the city decided that they were going to eliminate any permanent shelters. And they did that by going through and bulldozing what was there. They did a little. It was a little different this time, Robert, in that what they did was come through and pretty methodically take people's property and store it for 90 days. So anybody who had property that they left behind, it's been put into storage. It's not without its problems still, but they seem to have done a better job than they've done in the past.
You know, Mike, I remember we've talked about this a couple of years ago due to your $2.3 million successful lawsuit that got the money back to at least of some homeless people and successfully challenged Caltrans and the city authorities on this. Yeah, the Kincaid case, as I recall. You then, however, noted that even though they were storing it, they were storing property in leaky areas where the property was getting destroyed anyway. Has that changed, or?
Right. So what they've done now is put things in these 8x8x20-foot containers, and they're sealed so the rain doesn't get in. Yeah, you're right. At the beginning, they just put them in these open sort of pull-off containers that you'd throw roofing material and stuff in, and so it's totally open to the rain or whatever, and lots of property got destroyed at that time. But so now what they're doing is putting it into, they put it into a plastic bag, and in that plastic bag they put the location of where this property came from. If they have the name of the person, they put that on there. So they can go back later and find people's property that's specific to an area. So if somebody comes and says, I was on Santa Clara and East Street, they would know, theoretically, just where to go to find that person's property.
Mike, has anyone ever actually been able to reclaim their property successfully, or is this the very beginning of a whole new system that wasn't in place at all before?
No, it's changed over the years, and people have gone and got their property before, but it's never been easy. I don't know if it'll be easy this time either. One of the problems they had this time was one of the receipts they gave a woman for her property, for example. It listed her property, but it didn't say where she could go to reclaim it or give her a phone number to call to find out where it's being stored. She was bewildered about how to reclaim her property. And so they still got problems, but in the past the problems were even worse than that.
So this approach kind of breaks up communities that have set up, or do the people just come back and even though all their property has been taken away, they sort of huddle together where they were before? Or what's the result of these encampment destruction? What does the group of people that was then there, do they return to the place? Do they disperse? What happens?
Now, by and large, what happened, not everybody did the same thing, but a lot of people moved to another encampment that was, about two blocks away, and they've moved in there. So you have a migration of probably 50 to 75 of the people that were, of the 150 that were living there, went to one encampment, another 20 went to a different encampment. And the rest of the people, my understanding is that they continue to stay there. They are being allowed to put up a tent for the night. They can sleep on the sidewalk. They won't be forced to move on from sleeping on the sidewalk at night. But then in the morning, then they have to pack their tent and leave where they work. The purpose of that is that the city is, they don't want the re-emergence of any new encampment.
You've been
so you have people that have left and gone to different encampments. That won't be, those encampments are slated for destruction next Tuesday and then the following Monday. So people are safe there for another week or 2 weeks.
But there'll be a larger migration after that to another encampment, and it'll be display happening all around town, or?
Yeah, who the hell knows what'll happen after that. After you dislodge the several hundred people that were at these encampments, nobody knows where they're going because there's no plan for that. There is no shelters here. I say there's no shelters, but that's not exactly true. There are a few places for people to go, but maybe 150 or 200 beds for the homeless population in the thousands.
Now, your group, with some assistance from financial angels, has been providing porta-potties, dumpsters, toilet paper, other kinds of facilities like this. Are these facilities simply being destroyed or withdrawn? And what do people do? Would you just sort of move back in with the porta-potties afterward? Are you what's your approach going to be? Are you going to continue to provide these services?
Well, a couple factors play into that. One is that we haven't done anything with the portable toilets that are in the encampments that haven't been demolished. So those remain in place. The ones that were at the encampment that was destroyed this week have been pulled back, and I'm going to replace them wherever people end up at. So if everybody ends up at, like, you know, location Y, I'll put portable toilets out there. It's just not clear right now until the dust settles where people will end up. The other factor is that we're just about out of money on that. So we will need to get a new infusion of cash before we can do a whole lot more. I mean, we probably have enough for another month or so of services, but after that, we either need to get more money or, have them pull the portable toilets out because...
Well, you can simply put chamber pots and in the street, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose.
And you can bring them as offerings to the next city council meeting.
That's not a bad idea.
It's been proposed in different cities, and indeed including Santa Cruz. We're talking with Mike Rhodes, who's Community Alliance activist, worker in Fresno, writer, sometime videographer. By the way, is this all destroying your plans, your carefully laid plans to do a special tour of the encampments and video it so we can play it and make $1 million here in Santa Cruz?
Oh, yeah. Well, counting on that money, Robert, you are going to still come up with that, right?
Of course.
No, I don't know. I mean, if there's nothing, I mean, there'll be something there. We could certainly do that anytime we're in a position to film the dialogue of what's happened here. But, the problem is that I've just been totally consumed with this situation right now and documenting it and trying to deal with the outcome of people being displaced.
I mean, it seems to me, in a way, it's an opportunity to, do a video. Now we're at this encampment. Here are the services now. This is what it looks like. And here we see the destruction of this encampment by this particular, group of bureaucrats who... And why are you doing this, sir? It seems to me that could be a... It has even a more dramatic impact than simply doing a sort of a straight tour of existing encampments.
Yeah, you're right. There is definitely the potential there of making a statement about what is going on there today. It's just such a cruel and unusual policy that I don't know what the city of Fresno thinks the outcome will be other than to destroy people's lives. And, people will end up dying, getting really sick, and ending up in the hospital. I think they're hoping that people will, move some to Santa Cruz, perhaps.
Yeah, or to Modesto, or possibly Phoenix, Arizona. It's interesting. You don't unilaterally, you don't spend all your time, you know, dealing with the porta potty fundraising and cleaning and distribution and toilet paper, work. How large is the group that actually puts in energy on the ground on this issue? How many people are involved?
There's been a group that has emerged as a result of the city's plans. In fact, we have a meeting in about 10 or 15 minutes that I'm going to have to go to. There's around 30 people or so that have been coming every week to talk about providing both services, attending city council meetings, holding press conferences, you know, getting people in the community to speak out against what's the city policy. I mean, and that's just the people that come to the meetings. There's a lot of people behind that that are active in lots of different areas on homeless issues. So it's a pretty good, there's a new website up. I think it's Help Fresno Homeless. And if you Google that, you'll kind of pick up on what that new group is doing. I'm a part of that group, but I don't consider myself to be, you know, providing any direction for it. You know, I have some background knowledge that I share and help with the group, but it's like got its own dynamic. There's people from both faith-based groups, people, you know, in Food Not Bombs, people from a lot of different sectors in the community.
Any attacks on food serving in Fresno? We just had an interview with Keith McHenry and talking about attacks in Raleigh and Detroit and other places.
Yeah. We don't seem to have those problems here. I mean, it's not that it's never happened, but by and large, Food Not Bombs is able to operate just openly and continuously. And other than a few minor problems here and there, they've just continued to provide that service.
In Santa Cruz, you know, when the Iraqi war was about to break out, Huff and other groups formed the Vigil Against Two Wars, the war against the poor in Santa Cruz and then the war on the Iraqi people in 2003. There's a lot of talk about not a declaration of war, a de facto bombing of Syria coming up. Is there any, first of all, is there much indication of protest against that in Fresno? And then is there any talk of any kind of, you know, mixing of that issue with the homeless issue, which we do too here? Well, we have in the past. We haven't been doing it recently, but...
Well, I'd say that a lot of the people that are involved in both the anti-war work and homeless work are a lot of the same people. A whole bunch of people from Peace Fresno came to the press conference on Monday denouncing the attack on the homeless. And I have seen some emails that have been talking about some actions that will take place around the Syria situation, but... Frankly, I haven't followed that too closely.
You've also been concerned about police abuse, particularly because homeless people are particularly vulnerable to it. Any updates on police abuse, police accountability, self-defense by homeless groups around this issue, which is an important one in Santa Cruz, even though I haven't received a lot of reports in the last week or so of, you know, really straight-out police brutality in that regard. But with the increasing climate of hostility in Santa Cruz, we're finding this, people are being essentially warned away by this new, essentially, city council policy of we don't want this city to enable the homeless. It sounds like Fresno is adopting a similar approach. But anything around the police department abuse, if anything?
Well, the one new thing that's happening, Robert, is that the police have organized a task force on this homeless issue. So they're putting something like 8 or 10 people, reassigning them full-time to focus on forcing homeless people to move on. And that's different. And before, they've sort of spread it out through the entire police force, but now they've actually got a task force that's specifically organized around rousting homeless out of wherever they may re-emerge. So I anticipate more problems with the police than we've ever had before. because of that on this homeless issue. Otherwise, the Fresno Police Department is just unaccountable to anybody right now. Sorry to say that they engage in one police shooting after another. Just last week, they stopped two young men on bikes, and one of them took off, one of the bicycle riders took off and went down an alley. The police officer jumped in his car and drove after him and ran him down in the alley. And there's been no, like, even public outcry about that. It's just amazing that the police get away with shooting people, with running them over in their cars. You know, just people who are unarmed and running away from the police are shot with impunity, and it's really difficult to get any kind of conviction against the police or even hold them accountable, because they have a lot of power and control in this town.
Has the new widespread reality that people have cell phones had much impact in terms of posting instances of this on the internet and documenting this for the media?
Not a whole lot. I mean, even the one major case where that did happen, Glenn Beatty, who was a homeless man that the city beat, and it was captured on video, which was the only really unique thing about it, because that sort of stuff happens all the time. But this got, like, national attention, and the police then arrested Glenn, put him in jail, held him, like, in the Fresno County Jail for 6 months, then transferred him to some other facility out of town and declared him mentally incompetent to stand trial, assigned a worker to take care of his affairs, his legal affairs, and that person settled the case for something like $10,000. It was ridiculous. It was a shame that the city of Fresno was able to get away with their officers beating this guy, then putting him in jail, and jerking him around in the judicial system for over a year, and then settling the case for a pittance of, you know, what was at stake. I mean, this man was beaten by two officers, and, you know, one of the officers got a promotion, and, you know, there's just, like, no accountability, Robert. I kind of don't know what else to say about it. It's very frustrating having a police department.
Do you retain
people?
Hear you. You know, do you retain any kind of communication with homeless people or victims of police abuse in jail or in these custody situations? I ask this because we have a group here, Sin Baras, which is fighting for abolition of prisons or prison reform. It's supporting the general statewide hunger strike by prisoners. And here in Santa Cruz, the local issue, I mean, we're corresponding with a homeless guy in jail trying to hearing reports of the horrendous conditions inside the Santa Cruz County Jail. Do you have any kind of similar connections? Did you maintain connections with this Glenn Beatty guy, or is there some kind of communication going on so that people can hear what's going on outside, inside these jails and inside the situations like that?
Pretty much our newspaper is the one that reports on this in Fresno, and we have pretty frequent reports about it. People send us letters about what's happening with their family members. There's a number of trials going on. We do some coverage of that. I got a email just today from somebody, an attorney who works in the public defender's office, talking about how the cutbacks in their department have left them unable to defend indigent clients. And she was hoping that we would do a story about that. There's so much to cover out here. We could use more investigative reporters to tell the stories that need to be told.
How about just connections with people in jail? Do you correspond with any prisoners? Does anyone in your group do that with any regularity? Is there an attorney who's with your group who goes in to talk to them just about the general conditions and to maintain a line of communication?
Yeah, well, we have one writer, Boston Woodard, who writes from the state prison system. He's actually in one of the state prisons, and he writes regularly about those issues. I do maintain contact with a number of prisoners, people who are in the Fresno County Jail and other jails in the state of California. And we often tell their stories, either on indie media or Facebook or on the Community Alliance website. Robert, I'm going to probably have to leave it there because the meeting's about to get started, and I got to go.
Hey, thank you, and we'll talk with Mike Rhodes. We'll get back to you, Mike, and thanks a lot, man.
Okay, thanks. Talk to you later. All right.
Bye. Bye-bye. And if you want more information about the Fresno situation, you can use a search engine to find Mike Rhodes, R-H-O-D-E-S, Fresno Community Homeless Alliance. Check that out. He's worth following him. The Community Alliance newspaper has put out scores, if not hundreds, of articles on homeless issues over the last 6 or 7 years. Impressive stuff. And they actually have a fairly, I don't know how wide a circulation they have, but they have a pretty massive-looking paper that comes out either every month or every 2 months or every 2 weeks, not sure. You're tuned to the stream of Free Radio Santa Cruz, freakradio.org. This is live. If you're listening to us on August 29th, call-in number here is 427-3772. If you weren't able to call in, I got a busy signal. It was because we had Mike calling in from Fresno. Should have probably mentioned that we had a second line, but he didn't have a lot of time to talk anyway, and I was kind of trying to go back and forth. I was talking before about Cruzio Works. Local activists in Santa Cruz were protesting the abusive anti-homeless termination of his contract with Cruzio Works. He just actually signed up, according to his account, and I guess as sort of inferentially confirmed, we can't get a straight story, so we don't know for sure what their side really is saying. And I'll be reading to you what they do say when people ask them what actually happened. He and his son were... his son is a grown man who's slightly autistic. He has what's called Asperger's syndrome, and he does what's called stimming, which means he kind of rocks back and forth. He apparently was observed standing at his bike, which has homeless saddlebags, since they keep their stuff on their bikes, or they did then, while they were parked in the Cruzio Works area, the parking area, while Dan was inside paying the bill and setting up the situation. At this point, the son, Griffin, was approached by a woman who's a tenant in the building, apparently, who said, "You can't be here, you have to leave. You know, you're going to attract junkies, or you are a junkie," something to that effect. And then Dan came out and explained to this woman that they were customers there, and she seemed to be satisfied after some colloquy. But then later, 2 hours later, the management of Cruzio Works came to Dan and said to him, "Well, we've had complaints by email about, you know, this incident," as they called it, which... essentially, if Dan's account is to be credited, was simply one woman having apprehensive anti-homeless paranoia because she has no basis for believing that any of this, you know, that there's any problem with Dan. And certainly Cruzio has no basis in crediting her story without a full kind of, you know, investigation or hearing all sides of the issue. And Dan's written to them to try to get that kind of appeal, and they haven't even written back to him. There were several other people who did write to Cruzio. Steve Schnarr of the Bike Church. Jim Weller, another church activist from the Association of Faith Communities, I believe it's called. Scott Galloway of the Calvary Episcopal Church. All these folks wrote to Cruzio Works asking, you know, what went down. And they got this, apparently, was pretty much the same reply. And I'm going to read that reply with the permission of the people who got it on the air here. It's not very enlightening, but let me see what I got here, and we can pull it up. The initial letter that Jim Waller wrote was, I am a longtime loyal Cruzio customer. I'm in general very pleased with the service I've received and supportive of the organization, its work, and what I perceive to be its value. However, I have a very serious concern regarding a matter of management practice or policy that I want to discuss with someone who has authority to correct what I feel is a critical problem. I would like a response inviting me to meet in person with a senior manager to discuss my concerns at your office sometime next week. Thank you in advance for what I expect will be your courteous accommodation, Jim Weller, and he gives his cell phone number. And that letter, that email was written on August 24th. 3 days later, from the Cruzio customer service, from a woman named Sandy, that's the only response, the only name she gave, was, thanks for reaching out. Hi, Jim. Our management team take any customer questions extremely seriously and are always happy to discuss any issues. But without an idea of your area of concern, it's hard to know who on our team would be best placed to address them with you. If you could please email an outline of your concern, I'd be sure to ask the appropriate member of our senior staff to respond to you directly. Thanks again for contacting us. In other words, I didn't want to directly confront him. Since there was, we've been visibly and audibly and loudly protesting in front of their headquarters, picketing their store for two successive Fridays, actually not this last Friday, but the Friday before and the Friday before that, they might have some inkling as to what he's talking about. But he then wrote them back and said, Hi, Sandy. This was on August 29th, today, actually. My concern has to do with the experience of a man I know whose prepaid Cruzio Works Facilities use agreement was summarily terminated by Cruzio in a prejudicial and wrongful manner. It appears to me this man has been done a significant injustice, and I want to ask that proper amends be made. Regards, Jim Weller. And then he got this response, which I have read before. It is a form letter from a man named James... one moment... Hackett, and he writes, Hi, Jim. And this, it sounds, he sounds very friendly and personal, but this, it sounds like a word-for-word repetition of a letter that was sent to Steve Schnarr and another one that was sent to Scott Galloway. It reads as follows. Thanks for reaching out to us. While we never comment on the specifics or interactions with individual customers, I can say this. Cruzio Internet does not discriminate against any group or individual for any reason, nor do we tolerate discrimination from any of our employees. Now, notice that he, in the inquiry that Jim Waller made, he did not state specifically it was an issue of particular discrimination. So, it rather than talk to Jim Waller directly or have some other management person come and talk to him about what this problem was because they wanted to get an outline of it, because, and he gave a little closer in discussion, but he didn't really say exactly that he was referring to this episode. He gets a kind of... you can tell it's a form letter that he sent out to the two other people who did specifically refer to the incident of Dan Madison. And I think some of them by name. So he's using this blanket shield, this what I call a whitewash, what I call a stonewall. And it's a kind of even worse. It's a kind of a generic stonewall that shows both it's dehumanizing, it's distancing from the issue, which denies the pain and... the pain and suffering and discrimination that this kind of policy or practice entails, or this particular incident. But it also is a way of showing you we don't even have to waste time on and dealing with this individual specifically. We'll just send you this blanket form letter. It's something, you know, that a huge impersonal government organization might do. You would think that a group that, you know, bills itself as a kitty cat Cruzio group with the famous Cruzio cat would act somewhat differently. Anyway, the James Hammond letter, that's the office manager or the business development, marketing, and communications manager of Cruzio, writes... it is in our commitment to serve all individuals in our community who are eligible for our services and abide by our terms of use. Our Cruzio Works co-working center is open to the whole community as evidenced by our willingness to sign up members with no permanent address. Clearly, homelessness in itself is not an issue for us. Actually, this letter does read slightly differently, so maybe it's not exactly a form letter, but it, It does seem to adhere pretty much to the same tone and vagueness of the other letters. Cruzio Works has had members who are homeless, and some of our staff have been homeless. And then this is in bold. However, since co-working requires a mutual trust among all members, especially after hours when Cruzio's staff is not always on hand, we must be strict about our membership rules. We respond only to actions, do not make judgments based on categories, but it is our responsibility and our legal right to act when there is a concern. Now, here's a point that I'll interrupt this letter with to say that at no time has any specific claim been made or stated about any particular rule being broken or being there even to be potentially broken. It's simply, it's been left blank. For the last 25 years, James Hammond's letter continues, Cruzio has served the Santa Cruz community and supported many diverse local organizations, including Community Bridges, the Homeless Garden Project, and the Second Harvest Food Bank, with free and discounted services, donations, and active involvement. We stand by our track record of an ethical, non-discriminatory company with a long history of community involvement. I hope this goes some way to assuage your concerns. It seems either blind or clearly disingenuous to suggest that he thinks that Hammond could actually think this would assuage his concerns. It has nothing to do with assuaging his concerns. He wanted to meet with somebody to talk about it, and he's not getting that issue. That's what Jim Weller wanted to do. And I've invited him to listen into the show and call in if he wants. I invite anybody else who's had an experience trying to contact Cruzio or has any thoughts on this Cruzio Works discrimination issue to call in. It's something we're going to continue to pursue. I don't know that we'll be out there every Friday picketing, but we will continue to raise the issue wherever it seems appropriate, and it certainly seems appropriate whenever Cruzio Works appears with its little friendly Cruzio cat. We have our own version of the Cruzio cat with a thing that says Cruzio Haternet and shows a picture of the Cruzio cat clawing a homeless person. I also got a response from Joe Schultz, who's a longtime activist and supports homeless people in ways that are very, very upfront and very high profile. And so it kind of pained me that he was not interested in taking a stand here. He apparently has some divided loyalties because he has some friends at the Cruzio, and he doesn't want to second guess them, perhaps. I don't know. I've got to talk to him again. But he sent me a letter, and I sent him a rather, you know, come on, Joe. I mean, you're not getting a straight answer from these people. We're not getting a straight answer. You know, let's get some straight answers here, and just don't, we cannot support local discrimination against homeless people. And I still feel that way, and I'll continue to feel that way, I suspect, until I get a straight answer, and maybe even after that, depending on what the answer is and whether I'm satisfied by it. But I encourage you to send an email off to James Hammond of, or, you know, I don't know. That probably is maybe the best thing to do is to go on Yelp and suggest that if they're going to be recommend Cruzio Works to simply not be patronized, if they're going to, you know, simply if they're going to A, do what they're doing, and then B, refuse to allow appeal process, and then C, refuse to answer legitimate concerns by members of their own customers from their own group of their own business about the issue. The email address is, I guess, info@cruzio.com will do it. So if you're interested, send them an email saying, what's up, Doc? Come on. I don't appreciate hearing about discrimination. If you're not discriminating, then tell us what happened. Tell us what happened. And that might be you might be the straw that broke the bully's back. Could be. Or is it an ostrich? I don't know. So anyway, some more updates, which I have carefully noted, so I'm not going to skip over them. I have been successful in getting some Public Records Act requests supposedly met. I haven't yet looked over the public records. You may recall some weeks ago a homeless man, James, another James, actually a lot of James. We've got a Jim Weller and this James Hammond of Cruzio. Now we got this other James, who reported that he's a homeless guy in the library. He had a sign with him that was next to him, visible, but it wasn't blocking the way, or, you know, he wasn't holding it up and waving it around, but he was told, you can't have a sign like that in the library. And the sign didn't say anything like kill all librarians, or, you know, piss on the floor, or fuck the police, although those are all First Amendment protected activity. And the library is a public space, even though it's managed, you know, in terms of, you know, it has closing hours and so forth and rules. And I wanted to find out what the hell was going on here, why he was being threatened with exclusion for having a visible sign. And so I wrote to Teresa Landers, who is the chief librarian, and we had some correspondence. And I'm going to read you what some of that correspondence was after I draw it up on my rather pokey computer. The essence of it, here we go. First, I began the correspondence in the following way. This was back in July, on July 24th. I said, Teresa, because that's her name, Teresa Landers. This is the same woman who pushed sleep in the library and get banned, do it for a day, do it twice, and get banned for a month, and similar kinds of really crackdown anti-homeless rules and policies, which we were actually able to reverse, or at least to block, for a couple of months until a new board member joined the library. I think Cynthia Matthews was the new board member, and we lost. I wrote to her, Hi, I'm looking to view any library rules and regulations regarding visible signs carried or held by patrons in the library. It's my understanding that a patron was instructed not to have his picket sign visible recently on pain of being expelled from the main branch. He recently made a presentation before the local ACLU. Of course, they're not doing anything about it, but nothing new there. I'm not aware that there are any such regulations, but wanted to check with you to be sure. Also, I'm looking to view any complaints by staff or public regarding patron or staff behavior from April 1st through July 23rd. As was the case with an earlier request last winter, I may need to copy some of these, but right now I only need to view them. That's what you should always do, by the way. That's what I always do anyway. I suggest others do it too. If you're asking for making a Public Records Act request, ask that they be made available, not that you get charged for the copies that they'll make. Often they'll make all kinds of copies at 25 cents a page, or in some cases even more. You don't want that. You just want to see them, and you actually prefer to get email copies of public records. Please make the records available in e-form, in email form, or internet form if they exist. Additionally, if you will, please forward me the sign rules if they exist, or confirmation they do not if they don't exist. Please let me know before you begin the more extensive business of forwarding the records. Thanks in advance for your help. Please call me if you have any questions. And I sent that on July 24th. Teresa responded. What did she respond with? She responded actually the next day with the following. She sent me two attachments, which were a set of rules. One was their policy. If you want to post a notice or an ad or an announcement on one of their bulletin boards, which is not relevant really to the issue of having a sign with you. And the second is the library rules of conduct, which don't mention signs at all. So these were the two documents you sent me, and that was kind of interesting because I wondered under what rule this guy was being told he couldn't have a sign there, that he you know, he simply had it with him as part of his possessions. And indeed, he had showed it to a security guard before, and the security guard found it interesting, and they hadn't had any problem with it, but then some other librarian didn't like it. You know, this is the usual thing where one person could start vetoing the First Amendment just on a whim because they're in a position of power, and then they make a rule that completely nullifies the First Amendment because they want to be, quote, fair. I mean, this is an absurd kind of approach, but that's what they do. Here was her response. In response to your public records request, I am attaching the Joint Powers Board-approved library display policy. And those are the two documents I mentioned. It'd have nothing to do with his sign, but that's what they sent. That's what she sent me. In addition, the issue involved complaints from other patrons who were made to feel uncomfortable, which is a violation of our rules of conduct. No, making another patron uncomfortable because of, for example, the clothes you wear, the skin color you have, your housing status, your religion, the books you read, that cannot be a criterion for evicting you from a library or telling you to change your behavior. This can't be, because it is a violation of your privacy, your integrity as a human individual, human being. It's none of their business. And if somebody doesn't like it, they should move, you know, to another chair somewhere and read a book somewhere else. You know, I mean, they're not required to stare at you. And the idea that the sign would be there is somehow makes somebody uncomfortable. And that's a basis for exclusion. Teresa, that may be your basis for making policy changes that will then effectuate that kind of prejudice or those kinds of fears. But it is not any real basis, obviously, for excluding a person from a library. Of course, what she's done is she creates new rules based on this so that people will have there'll be a way to tell them to shape up or leave, where shape up means don't show this, don't wear that. If you fall asleep at all, we're going to hassle you, even if nobody else cares, and if it is, you're not blocking anything. And the library is one of the last sanctuaries for poor people in this town who have no other place to go. It becomes a means or a tool, as the police department likes to say, of all the new nasty laws that the city council passes for moving around homeless people and making them unwelcome, as the city council really wants to do, and as the public safety, which should be called the public unwelcoming committee of the hand-picked Bryant committee that meets every other Wednesday, has been trying to do. If you want to see, Teresa Landers continues in her email, the patron instance going back to April 2011, you can view them by making an appointment with the city clerk's office. Those instances are not kept on file at the library, but they're maintained by the city of Santa Cruz Risk Management. They're not available in electronic form. So yesterday I actually tried to do that. I went to the library. Not to the library. I went to the city clerk's office. I'd like to see the documents. Oh, we don't have them. You have to go to the risk management. Well, I went over to the risk management. Oh, we don't have them. Besides, the head of risk management is on vacation. They'll be back next week. And I said, no. This notice to me was sent on July 25th. It is now August 27th. Actually, August 28th was yesterday. So show me the records. I mean, come on. But, I mean, she obviously didn't know what was going on, the woman who was the secretary, so she couldn't really do that. So, well, call me, you know, let me know what's going on. She didn't call me. So I called back today and sent an email following up to Patty Hammond, who is a rather highly strung, long-time ossified bureaucrat at the City Hall. I say this because I'm remembering she was a witness that tried to stop homeless activists from peacefully and legally sitting in the mayor's waiting room during the winter, because we wanted to talk to city council members who would come in and out through that area, and where the public was allowed to be. We were driven away from there by an injunction, and she was one of the witnesses that was trying to show that we were just a very bad group of people, and we would do things like we would give a $20 bill and ask for change and horrible things of that sort. Anyway, I don't like Patty Hammond from that old incident, but that is 13 years old, so I should probably back off. In fact, I left her a message today, and she apparently is out of the office. But in response to my message and my email, which I also copied to the city clerk's office, I was informed this afternoon that the records are available down at the city hall. So the relevant point is not that, oh, I did such a wonderful thing, rah-rah for Robert Norris, although that's fine, I don't mind a pat on the back, thank you. But it's also available for those who want to read complaints about the library, people being in the library to see what the so-called problems are in the library, the main branch. Those records are now sitting in the city clerk's office, and they'll be available during business hours 8 to 12 and 1 to 5 every Monday through Friday, at least for the next week, hopefully for a longer period of time. I did this before when the library pushed its sleep and thou shalt be evicted policies and this other crackdown, harshly intensifying penalties in the library, even for minor offenses. And the records finally did show up, and people could look at them. And I don't think a lot of people did. I think I maybe and one or two other people were the only ones who looked at them. But that they need to be accessible is, I think, beyond doubt, and I'm glad they were made accessible. But that didn't end the correspondence I had with Theresa Landers. I wrote her back, and I said on August 8th, Theresa, thanks for your response. I see nothing in these rules that prohibits having a sign with you while using the library, provided it's not obstructing anyone's way. Is this accurate? And Theresa, on the next day, fairly promptly, wrote me back, a sign being displayed would count as an exhibit or display would be expected to conform to the rules laid out in these policies. I got to say that this is patently absurd. I mean, you display things. If I walked in with a sign on my back, I would be displaying it. But it wouldn't be. I wouldn't be asking to exhibit it in the library as an exhibit or on one of their bulletin boards. Although I think those should be accessible to the public more so than they are. Landers continues, there is a designated area for the display of information by individuals and groups. That is the bulletin board in the lobby for downtown and other designated areas and other branches. The appropriate place for the display of sign is that designated area as long as it conforms to the policy. So that means that any First Amendment activity involving display of a sign can only be in this very, very limited zone after you've gone through a policy check with the library board or the librarian who's handling the bulletin board. This, of course, is preposterous. I can't believe that Landers could do this with a straight face, but since nobody's checking her and she has power in what is essentially an anti-homeless climate by a library board that has already made it a banning offense to fall asleep twice in the library, even to doze off, she probably feels she can do this kind of shit with impunity. So my response is simply to further document it. I wrote her back. So to be perfectly clear, are you saying that if I'm carrying a sleep is not a crime or a vote for Obama 2014 sign and set it down next to me while reading a book in the library in such a manner that it's still visible, your staff will accuse me of violating library policy and require me to conceal it or leave? Her response, which was the next day, promptly, was, any sign that is used in a manner that indicates it is being used as a display would be asked to comply with the display exhibit's policy. Content is irrelevant. At which point I sent her this letter the same day, and this was on August 10th, 2 weeks ago, more than 2 weeks ago. Would that include T-shirts or signs being held as part of one's possessions but visible to someone walking by, like, you know, on your back or attached, you know, buttons attached to your large, you know, patches? And her response was zero. She did not respond. So I wrote her again today, and I wrote, several weeks ago I sent you the following questions regarding library policy. Perhaps I missed your email. Please advise me. And I sent her the previous emails. So we'll see if Theresa will have some more amusing commentary for us on Sunday. She may, you know, she tends to respond the next day, so maybe she'll respond tomorrow, and we'll have some more information. That's one Public Records Act that is available if you want to read about library, what librarians consider to be bad behavior in the library, what they consider to be complaints, what members of the public, if any, are complaining about. Those records are now available. Just go to the desk of the city clerk's office in at the city hall and say, I would like to look at the Norse library documents, because I've already informed the staff there that anybody who wants to look at them should be able to look at them, and that's why I've asked for them. So check them out if you'd like. I requested other documents. I did want to say, though, before I get to that, it looks like Theresa of the library, as I call her, will be out of the office until September 3rd, the day after Labor Day. So we won't be hearing from her probably until next week. However, she can be reached by cell phone, or there will be another person to contact. I think I will send her send that email off to the person who's supposed to be acting in her behalf. And the point, of course, here is, quite frankly, I don't expect a reasonable response from these people. They don't seem to be reasonable. They seem to be rational in the sense that they are they complete their sentences properly. They're grammatically correct. They're the kind of bureaucratic double talk which you find in various governmental agencies that don't really want to address real issues directly or hide behind bureaucratic regulations. And that is what's happening here. I mean, it is obviously a profound violation of personal dignity for not just homeless people, but anybody to be told you can't wear a button in a library, you can't have a sign with you if you happen to be walking around, provided it doesn't interfere with anybody. And to be told that this is actually part of an existing policy with a set of rules that already exist when they don't exist is simply a lie. Landers is lying. Well, I'm going to call her, maybe I'll be calling her Lying Landers in the future. I don't know. But it's not good. But it's important to document it so people can see just the lengths to which and the absurdities that people will mouth with a straight face because they believe they are in positions of power that enable them to do so, and they will not be corrected either by those above them or by those below them, who are really the only correcting agency that is worth a salt. That's worth a shit, I should say, and is worth its salt. Other public records that I learned are available are the what I call the Crone... Well, I thought they were the Crone-Crapper Commission reports. And let me explain that. Christopher Crone was mayor of Santa Cruz in 2002. In 1999, he was working on a group called the Task Force on Bathrooms, Public Bathrooms. I called it the Crone-Crapper Commission because it was such a crappy commission. He never got the bathrooms, even though he had a majority on city council to put them into effect. They were stalled and delayed. And they did put in some porta-potties for about 3 or 4 years until the police, using the excuse that they were being used for prostitution, that they were being used for drugs, and that, you know, people, I don't know, maybe masturbation, perhaps, or taking a poo-poo. You know, that's not a very nice thing to do either. In any case, that they were being improperly used, had them all pulled out. And I wanted to find out how many police complaints were actually made around one of those porta-potties, the last one to go, which was, old-timers may remember, at the Cathcart and Cedar parking lot, which has now been taken over by the Farmer's Market on Wednesdays. It used to be the Drum Circle area where this porta-potty was. And I wanted to know if there actually was any basis for these claims by the police department, which loves to make these inflammatory statements. You can read one in the Good Times this week. Today, the Good Times came out with Steve Clark was attacking Brent Adams' sanctuary camp idea, denouncing it. It would never work. It's never worked before. They all fall apart. It's filthy and horrible and ugly and dirty and all that sort of thing. Those are those homeless camps, you know. And, you know, Clark is entitled to his opinion. The fact that he, however, is he's representing you in the police department, or he is in a position of power, allowed to remain there by individuals on the city council, is gross and grotesque. That's true. The city council can't fire him, but it can pressure the city manager to censure him, for instance, and it can get the city manager can direct the police chief to fire him. Of course, there has to be adequate cause, and his union has to be consulted, and all that sort of thing. But there is a way of reining in this kind of bigotry, which, in Clark's case, is of long-standing and a deep and violent kind of bigotry, as far as I've seen in my experience with Clark over the years. He's the only person who's ever assaulted me as a police officer, when he was the Sergeant-at-Arms at City Council in 2005. Even before I was told I was under arrest, he was putting me in a pain compliance hold, and I was screaming like a girl, as you might say. I was screaming, you know, ouch, ouch, don't, you know, that sort of thing. Because I was at the mic trying to speak for 2 minutes and not being allowed to do so by Mayor Mike Rotkin, who would go to, apparently, rather extreme lengths to enforce his new rules on consent agenda items, which I've talked about in the past. Anyway, the public records about the Crone, about the issue of public bathrooms is important because there's a new public bathroom, porta potty being put in, an extremely highly priced porta potty, $15,000, I think, or thereabouts, supposedly around the community credit union up, or the, one of the parking lots, the government city parking lots there. And I pointed out before that this whole thing was is a recipe for failure, not because we don't need porta potties, we do, but because there are, all you have to do is spend, if you're going to spend $15,000, keep the bathrooms that are already available nearby in San Lorenzo Park and at the parking garage across from New Leaf Market on Soquel open all night. Very simple. And if you want to, you have to pay someone as a guard to walk up and down and examine everyone's genitalia. Well, then you do, but at least they have a fairly decent facility that gets cleaned regularly to go to, and you don't spend an absurd amount of money for a porta potty. And also, you're treating the entire population in a uniform manner. You aren't creating a special homeless porta potty by the levee that those dirty homeless people can go use. So it is clearly, I think, a better idea. Not that Micah Posner is taking it up, although admittedly, I probably should send it to him and say, why aren't you doing that? I've kind of given up talking to him. It's very frustrating to talk to Micah about these political issues because he's so obviously diluting everything you're saying while at the same time nodding and encouraging you to go on. It's just very frustrating for me. So I wanted to find out, you know, just what the story, what was the mythology or the true facts that closed down the porta potties in 2002, 2003. And I was told that they don't have the records beyond 2002, which isn't true, I'm pretty sure. Although, how would I be sure of that? I don't know. It seems unlikely that those records would be not available, but maybe they aren't. I think they did have some records that they tried to send me, but then they sent me a document that I couldn't open, and it required me to get a special viewer service online that required paying money to open up. And so that's something I told them I didn't want to do. If you have to print out all the damn documents, and I'll look at it, but I'm not going to pay you a penny. I just want to see them. So we'll see how that goes. But some of those documents, public bathroom documents, are available. And what they made available looks like mostly stuff that is more recent around the controversy about a public bathroom or a public porta potty, not opening up the public bathrooms at night, but having a porta potty for $15,000, you know, on Front Street near the levee. So if you're interested in those documents, they are also available at the city clerk's office after a Public Records Act request was made, and that's good, I guess, although the documents are not terribly illuminating, but if anybody wants to check them out and get back to me with their own thoughts, I would be interested. Keith McHenry will be calling in again on Sunday, the co-founder of Food Not Bombs. And he has also written about the Santa Cruz 11. That is the 11 defendants, of which I was one, seven of whom have been discharged as insufficient evidence of any kind of crime. In other words, it was a bunch of horse shit that they were doing. They were trying to dragnet activists, intimidate them, and successfully were intimidating a lot of us in order to destroy the Occupy Santa Cruz movement. And that worked too, although it was probably destroying itself, or, you know, was... that may not be a fair thing to say. Occupy Santa Cruz still does meet every Saturday at 5:30, and I'm often there. They're kind of a hearty, long-standing group of a few activists who continue to pass resolutions, raise issues around the concerns that the 2011 Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Santa Cruz were trying to address in much larger numbers. A lot of it has to do with homeless civil rights issues because many of the people there are now actually housed homeless activists from Huff or other places. But what Keith McHenry did at my request was he wrote his analysis of the Santa Cruz 11 case as he perceived it. And it's relevant because four of the Santa Cruz 11, I call them the final four, as I mentioned on the show before, went back to court and are facing 4 years in prison for simply being at a protest that peacefully occupied a vacant Wells Fargo leased bank building. Wells Fargo being, of course, one of the prime, if not the prime, fraudulent forecloser in the nation. And I would guess also in Santa Cruz as well. And in performing a public service by exposing their foreclosures, by trying to use a vacant building that had been vacant for 3 years before that, now vacant for 5 years, they were punished. Because you're not supposed to do that. The punishment was 2 years now, going into the second year, actually, of court harassment, high bail, being jailed before being taken to court. That happened with three of us. And dragged to court repeatedly, again and again and again, under threat of being jailed and being released on an OR condition that would allow police to arrest people if they walked by the Wells Fargo Bank building, the vacant 75 River Street building. It was a grim farce that I saw firsthand myself, and four people are still faced with it. Brent Adams, Gabriella Ripley Phipps, Cameron Lorando, and Angel Alcantara. And they face a count of vandalism, felony vandalism, and trespass. Not because there's any evidence that any of them vandalized anything, but that there is evidence that some other vandalism occurred. The police don't know who. They were present, and therefore they're responsible because they trespassed into the building, along with Catherine Byers and Steve Plage and me and all kinds of other people, who they also, some of whom they chose to charge, but then they couldn't make it stick, and some of whom they didn't charge because Catherine Byers is a former council member, and you don't want, he was actually an active council member when this was going on. Santa Cruz Sentinel photographer Samuel Thayer Schmuel was in the building taking photos. You know, I mean, it's complete crap. And so Keith wrote about this issue. The recent update on the case is they had another status hearing on the, I guess it was yesterday morning, Wednesday morning, and I guess Brent Adams showed up and a couple of other activists were watching, and they posted a description of it online. Let me see if I can pass that on to you in case you, all you listeners out there haven't picked up on it. It's on Santa Cruz Indie Media. And it reads as follows. Let me see. Brent Adams reported. He's got a great picture of himself with a garbage can in front of the 75 River Street. And it says, this guy distributing garbage containers at a building occupation is being charged with felony vandalism. And Brent writes, I was in court on August 16th and the 28th for a status conference. I'm facing felony vandalism and misdemeanor trespassing charges filed by DA Bob Lee based on evidence collected by SCBD. Evidence is in quotes. This is from the occupation of a long vacant bank building at 75 River Street in late 2011. The building is owned by the local mega developer Barry Swenson and leased for many years by the bank across the street, Wells Fargo. There had been more than 300 people who crossed the threshold of the building in the course of the three-day occupation, and eventually 11 people will be charged with two separate felonies and two discrete trespassing charges. Finally, 7 out of the 11 had all their charges dropped based either on assertions that they were there as journalists or that they hadn't returned to the building after being warned of the trespass. Now, nearly 2 years later, and after several judge changes, a new assistant DA has been appointed. The old one was either fired or resigned after, in a very rare situation, the judge in the case had to find that she was either Well, he didn't find it was willful, but it was, to me, it was obviously willful. She was negligent at best in repeatedly refusing to follow court orders to turn over evidence to the defense. All the evidence, all the videos, all the reports, all the policy state, all policy guidelines. She kept kept saying she was doing it, and then she wasn't doing it. This went on week after week, month after month, between February of 2012 and August of 2012. And then by the time it came to January 2013, the judge finally imposed the weakest possible sanction, a $500 sanction. Anything over $1,000 would have required that she actually be examined by the Bar Association. And Burdick was very candid, saying, I don't want the Bar Association to look at this. And I couldn't get my attorney, David Beauvais, to file a complaint with the Bar Association about this attorney because apparently he's had his own problems with the Bar Association. Maybe he doesn't want to be. Who knows what these attorneys, what their rationales are. And it's difficult for me because David's a friend of mine. I don't like mentioning this particularly, but I also feel it's important that we know what the kinds of problems they can develop with attorneys not carrying forward the struggle in the way they need to. So anyway, Lee has been appealing all this, the sanction, the $500 sanction that was against his department because of Rebecca Young's incompetence and probable malice. And we couldn't get any of the attorneys to file a brief opposing Lee's attempt to slip out from under these sanctions. That doesn't mean he'll get away with it. According to one legal observer, it's unlikely that the higher courts are going to reverse a judge on this. I guess that's not necessarily a good thing either. A judge shouldn't have any special status. The question is, what's the real justice or truth of the claims involved? Anyway, there's a new DA on the scene, and apparently he's a real bulldoggy kind of DA. His name, according to Brent, is Greg Pinedo. We're still hanging tough, Brent continues. There's been a plea offer made to us, but we're not budging. Why would I plead guilty for shit I didn't do? I was there on principle in the first place, so I'm not about to take the easy path out just because I'm fearing jail time. Well, Brent, my hat's off to you. I mean, it's a difficult thing to do, and Brent has often felt like he's been isolated from the other defendants. He had hoped there would be a lot of solidarity with other people who were actually in the building, and people would come out and say, I was in the 75 River Street. The only person I know who came out and said that was Ed Fry. Thank you, Ed, for doing that. Others were so scared of being charged, and it's understandable because it took up dozens of hours. It took up thousands of dollars for people who got there, had to hire attorneys. It was an effective repression tool. But still, there are those who think, have this sort of fantasy that if only we all say, I am Spartacus. No, I am Spartacus. People stand up and refuse to stand up in solidarity with other people, honestly acknowledging that they too were there. It would have a real impact. And I toyed with that idea too. But it didn't happen. And doesn't mean it won't happen in the future. Doesn't mean it can't happen. Doesn't mean it isn't a laudable idea. It's one of the reasons, though, I think that it's an example of great courage when Brent continues high-profile activist work as he's doing, not just on the sanctuary movement, trying to get a sanctuary campground, which I have had a lot of criticism of in different ways for different reasons, and activists will disagree about these things, but also exposing the brutal treatment of Richard Hardy by the officer who dropped him face down on the sidewalk or let him fall in handcuffs face down on the sidewalk. Adam's been as outspoken on a number of things, and I'm glad he is still. Although he does so often impulsively, and that can have a double edge. Now, he writes, nearly 2 years later and after several judge changes, a new assistant DA has been appointed. I mentioned that already, actually. After nearly 2 years, we're still pre-trial. We've been dragged back to court over and over and over. There's still no end in sight. Okay, now for my report on the proceedings of the past few days. Please note, my report is incomplete because I really don't pay much attention to this bullshit. Court report. On August 16th, the assistant DA had indicated that two police witnesses had schedule conflicts with the pending trial date. Then-attorney Alexis Briggs, who's attorney for Gabriella Ripley, she's attorney for Cameron Lorando, also said that her pregnancy might cause a conflict. Then two other attorneys, including Lisa McCammy, that's Brent's attorney, who is my court-appointed defender, told the judge that other cases they are working on posed a schedule conflict. I think Jesse Rubin said he had a murder case. He's Angel Alcantara's attorney. And, of course, all these other cases are being, you know, pushed back because of the demand of DA Bob Lee to appear white as the driven snow when he's really deep in the mud with all this crap, you know, where he's acting as Wells Fargo's bagman for essentially looking for restitution from these defendants. He wants the four defendants to plead guilty to a felony, vandalism, or trespass charge, and kick down, I don't know, $23,000 restitution, which is just ain't going to happen. So he's told his attack dog, Greg Pinedo, to continue with this bullshit. And, the community needs to respond to this. Judge Burdick also asked this assistant district attorney if the people thought it necessary to go forward with the case, given the profound expense it would cost, considering the damage amount is only $20,000. It would cost like several hundred thousand dollars to do a 2 or 3 week felony trial for four defendants. It's going to cost a lot of money. Juries, judges, courtrooms. It isn't cheap. Pinedo stated that the community he is hearing from does want to see a jury trial. I'd like to see what community he's hearing from. The status conference was rescheduled August 28th to assess scheduling conflicts, and on August 28th, which was yesterday, the attorney for Cameron Lorando, Alexis Briggs, confirmed that her pregnancy will create a conflict with the scheduled jury trial. Burdick then rescheduled a new trial for March 3rd, 2014. That's nearly 2.5 years after the incident, with a readiness hearing on February 27th. The assistant DA Pinedo stated that Gabriella Ripley Phipps would have to reinstate her bail bond as the current one had elapsed. And this is a situation. She's the only one that I've heard that actually posted bail in order to... She was advised by her attorney she had to post bail. I just went down and signed an OR release, and so did other people. And apparently, I guess some people were angry with the clerks for doing this because they wanted to force us all to post bail. It's a form of punishment without trial, punishment on through a court process that doesn't require them to be accountable or transparent in what they're doing, that they can just hide behind these procedures and punish us for political activity, for exposing Wells Fargo, for showing the need for a community center or a homeless shelter during the winter, all of which is a community service. But they're punishing us for exposing this community's defects. And Gabriella Ripley Phipps was punished by having to pay $500 for a $5,000 bail, and now she's told she's going to have to do it again because the bail has, quote, expired. Why? Because the trials keep getting postponed because this huge trial, which is still huge with four people, it was immense with 11 people, but with four people it was huge. It's still huge, and it's the scheduling conflicts are just difficult to resolve. They need, obviously, to drop the charges, but they probably now are afraid of some kind of civil lawsuit. I suppose they could offer as a deal, no lawsuit and we'll drop the charges. Because I don't know if any attorney necessarily has any balls to take this lawsuit, though. Alexis Briggs is an out-of-town attorney from San Francisco's Pier 5, and she might. Or there might be someone at Pier 5 who would be interested. Any case, Brent's account of the hearing yesterday of the final four of the Santa Cruz 11 continues. Ripley Phipps was told by her attorney to take out a bail bond. I, Brent Adams, simply turned myself into the sheriff's department. Burdick then asked if Miss Ripley Phipps is a danger to the community or a flight risk. Pinedo stated that she had been arrested at Occupy Oakland following her arrest in San Francisco last year, and that indicated that she is a danger to her community. No, an arrest does not indicate you're a danger to anything, particularly when no charges are ever filed. I've been arrested repeatedly in Santa Cruz for the most ridiculous things. Standing next to a Metro sign while advising homeless people that they don't have to talk to a security guard unless they want to, accused of trespass. Burdick agreed and stated that Ripley Phipps must now repost a bail bond. So they're going to squeeze more money out of Gabriella because they are delaying the trial, and they claim she's a flight risk. Any time in the last few years she could have run, she hasn't. None of us have. We know this is all a bunch of horse shit. Doesn't mean the jury will believe it, because in these courtrooms with judges who are giving credence to this kind of crap, you are not safe. The public safety task force is wondering about public safety. Look at the courtrooms. Look at the defendants. Look at homeless people. See if they feel safe. Of course, we have to have our own public safety hearings on those issues. So, you can read more about this at Santa Cruz Indie Media, indiebay.org/Santa Cruz. The latest story there is Santa Cruz 11 report, Brent Adams. And thank you, Brent, for that report. I also gave a report earlier, which you can read. Santa Cruz 11 back in court, DA Bob Lee's Big Top up for fall engagement, meaning are they? I regard this as a huge circus show, and I also post on that website Bob Lee's 49-page multi-thousand-dollar law brief opposing a $500 sanction against his department for its incompetent and abusive DA behavior, which should have resulted in all charges being dropped against all defendants and charges being filed against these damn DAs who are in contempt of court. If I tried such a thing, I would be in jail. If I were ordered by the court to provide evidence and I did not do so repeatedly, again and again, I wouldn't be sitting at this mic talking to you today. So, you can read more about this in detail on Santa Cruz Indie Media. Not that anybody necessarily will, or that it's terribly productive to do so. Interesting enough, the latest story on Indie Bay is former Take Back Santa Cruz hero Dylan Grainer removed as Santa Cruz Clean Team Administrator after arrest. So he was actually the Clean Team online administrator, according to this story, which I will go into next Sunday when I will have more time. I think what I'm going to do is just give you one other voice, at least, on this show, so that I can say that somebody other than me and the two people who called in spoke. This is an interview with Raven from a couple of weeks ago. Raven is a story in the current Street Spirit. You can find it at the library. You can also find it online at the Street Spirit. Look it up in a browser. And she's an activist. She's a masseuse. She's a vendor of Street Spirit, or at least has been occasionally in the last few months, and an activist with Occupy Santa Cruz, as well as with Huff. And here is an interview with her about harassment around the massaging issue, massage on Pacific Avenue. So we're here at the Huff meeting, and we have a report from a writer and activist, Raven. How would you like to be known?
Playfair.
Raven, who plays fair and is Playfair.
So over the last couple of months, you know, I was doing chair massage out on the mall with my little massage chair, and I was actually encouraged when I first got to town. I mentioned to one of the hospitality ladies that I was a massage therapist and I had a chair, and I said, you know, do you think I could, you know, get away with bringing it out here? And she's like, oh, yeah, sure. So I did. And then sometime later, I was shown an ordinance that said I could do massage, or I could do things without, as long as I wasn't charging a price. I think that was the ordinance that was shown to me.
Who brought that to your attention?
One of the other hospitality ladies.
I see. So they kind of a little of this and a little of that from different hospitalities.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So, and I guess they train different ones to concentrate on different aspects of city ordinances.
Or they get you coming and going arbitrarily, telling you one thing, and then the next day telling you something different. Again, part of the, I wouldn't call it planned, but effective hostility approach that's actually an unwelcoming group, an unwelcoming approach that really was the whole purpose of the hospitality squad when it was set up by Catherine Byers back in 1995. It was supposed to be her alternative or her addition to the downtown ordinances to make it more palatable and to advise people when they were stepping over the wrong lines, in the wrong zones, and so forth. But they actually became something that was the eyes and ears of the police department. We actually have a caller. This is historic. Let's see who it is. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Uncle Robert.
Sir.
Hey, I just wanted to give you a little tidbit before your show ends.
Good.
I don't know if you realize, but just because Free Radio is not broadcasting on the air, it does not mean that only people sitting at home on their computers are listening or can listen. And I never thought about this till today when I was on the road and thought about listening. I usually listen through the archives, but today I just felt like listening. So anybody basically that has a smartphone can listen anytime, anywhere they're at. All you have to do is on your smartphone, you would Google Free Radio Santa Cruz Listen, and then click on the web link, and then it takes you into the listen page, and then once you're there, it's going to ask you to install this little app on your smartphone called TuneIn Radio. But once you have that on there, you can literally just walk around wherever you are, put your headphones on, you have your smartphone, and you're hooked up. You're hooked in, just like you have a radio. So, didn't know if you knew that. Thought you might want to, you know, let people know if they don't know. I'm sure a lot of people do know, but I didn't know,
and that's really, not only is that good information that you're putting out now, I'm going to post it on the Huff website, and I'm going to, maybe I'll put it up as a little story on Santa Cruz Indie Media, because I think that's something people need to know if they don't already.
Yeah, it's good to know. It's, you know, like I said, something I never really thought about till today when I was out and about. So.
And I think I recognize your voice, caller, so you better watch
your step. Yeah, you might.
Hey.
All right, well, thanks for your show, Robert.
And thanks for calling in with that info, man.
All right.
Bye-bye. Wow, someone's still listening and providing useful information. Boy, that's a double barrel. Let's get back to Raven Playfair talking about contradictory information from different hosts on different days.
They simply change their mind, or they sort of an impressionistic approach at the moment.
Yeah, I don't know. I got the impression that they have their specialties. Like one will look for the spatial factors, and another will pay attention to ordinances and various things. So, at first I was under the impression that it was fine for me to hang a sign out that said how much I charge.
Which was?
I charge $1 a minute, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, between 10, 15, and 20 minutes mm-hmm. is what I do.
And how did you do that? Was the business good?
Yeah, I did fine. I have a little sign that I charge $10 for 10 minutes, but then I give a little price break at 15 minutes, and I charge $12.50, and then I charge $15 for 20 minutes.
What was your average take on an average day?
Average?
For tax purposes, of course.
Right. I'd say about 30. Yeah, I mean, there were some days I'd go out and get nothing. Other days I might go out and make as much as 70 or 80 bucks, but that was rare.
And you were also selling street spirit when you could.
When I could, and unfortunately...
Homeless newspaper.
Right, and as time went by, you know, I'd put them on the table, and I sold mostly street spirits when I could hawk them.
Mm-hmm.
But once I started doing... chair massage, it didn't seem appropriate to hawk them, so I just had them on the table. Nobody ever asked for them, not even once, sadly.
Very depressing.
Yeah, I agree.
But there's not much local news, except in the current Street Spirit, the August issue, which is apparently a story by you about the very thing you're discussing, although not in the detail and up to the date, up to the moment now that you're giving us your report.
That's correct. So the last thing that was happening was I was told by... one of the rent-a-cops in the mall, and yet another one of the hospitality people, actually the original hospitality people, person that had encouraged me. She said that there apparently was a gray area and that they had decided that chair massage was not appropriate on the mall. And
was
I kept
wondering... sexual overtures to all the people?
No, no. Apparently other people finally picked up on my bright idea of doing chair massage, and one of them got into an argument with a cop. But there were some young men doing chair massage out on the mall and had a big sign that said free massage. Mm-hmm. This happened to be back in like April or May, when I happened to be too sick to be going out on the street at all. So I didn't, you know, I wasn't, it's funny, they seem to have been out on the streets doing chair massage at the times when I haven't been.
And you began this when?
I began this back in March, I believe. Yeah. And so the last thing that was said to me was that they, whoever they are, had decided that chair massage was not appropriate on the mall. And then I finally got talked to by a real cop.
Oh.
And they took a little picture of my sign, and, you know, that said how much I charge.
Sort of a memento, a keepsake.
Right. And then told me, you know, I had to stop. And they said, well, we understand you've been in conversation with people out of on the mall, and so you know that you're not supposed to be out here, or something to that effect. So I was totally unclear at that point, like, who was right and who was wrong. So finally, maybe a week later of being too intimidated to come out onto the mall, and this was about a month ago, I grabbed the first cop who had kind of waved at me when I was talking to a client but hadn't really talked to me, but then had gone and talked to his boss, who then was the one who talked to me directly.
Remember the cop?
I would say Bush, but I think that was one of the ones that passed away.
Bush was the sergeant. Baker was the one who got shot.
Right, okay. Yeah, I did get the name at the time, but now I have since forgotten it. It was a Hispanic-looking man. Mm-hmm. That much I remember.
It wouldn't be Bush. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I went. I kind of grabbed him one day on the mall, and I said, "So, what is it? I've been told three different things: that it's okay, and that it's okay to put up a sign. I've been told it's okay to be out there, but not put up a sign. I've been told it's not okay to be out here at all. So, which is it?" And they said, "Well, you can do massage as long as it's for free." And this is coming directly from a real cop,
sergeant or an officer.
I don't know that.
Name of the source?
That's what I'm saying. I got the name at the time, but I have since forgotten it, unfortunately. Didn't write it down.
The pencil and paper approach.
And this was the... Oh, hold on a second. This was the Hispanic-looking gentleman. So let's see. So the last thing I was told by a real cop was that I was okay to be out there as long as I didn't hang a shingle out.